Hey creatives, welcome to the podcast. My name is Courtney and I'm so glad you're here. Each week, we get to hear stories and insights from leaders in the Catholic creative world. In Ezekiel 34, God says, "I myself will pasture my sheep. I myself will give them rest. The lost I will search out. The strays I will bring back. The injured I will bind up. And the sick I will heal." It was this chapter in Ezekiel that helped set today's guest, Ryan Thomas, on the path he's on today. What I love about his story is not that it's impressive. Okay, yes, it is very impressive and it's so fun to listen to. I mean, in just 1 hour of this podcast, you'll hear about basketball Bible camp and blockchain and St. Ignatius and hackathons. But Ryan's story isn't just about being the Catholic Indiana Jones. It's about God. It's about God bringing sheep home. About God letting Ryan, letting all of us, have adventures in the pastures and then rest in loving arms. It's about the shepherds on earth who lead us back to the good shepherd and teach us how to be good shepherds ourselves. I'm grateful to be learning that same humble reliance on my shepherd and to have really incredible people like Ryan Thomas to learn from. Enjoy the podcast.
Ryan, welcome to the Catholic Creatives Podcast, dude. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, my friend. It's good to be here. Been looking forward to this since we were together in Texas.
Yeah, it's really good to have you on. I mean, last time I saw you, you were at the summit. You were not wearing anything too crazy for the ball, but there were definitely some flowers.
Yeah, I think I was on definitely the more conservative side of the attire. The problem is, I didn't get that email. So I was in Mexico a week before, and I got the email. And so I was Mexico, and then I was someplace else, and then I came into Dallas. And so by the time I saw attire, I was just like, well, guess I'm going conservative Ryan as normal.
As normal, man, yeah. No, yeah, that's your thing, though. You know how to, like, navigate those circles. You know how to, like, look the look. So.
It is my thing. I get comments on that all the time, you know? Like, we got to spice it up a little bit, but...
Wow. You're the creative who knows how to look like a stiff.
I'm a stoic.
Yeah, man. So tell me a little bit, and for everybody else that doesn't know you, like, what are you up to these days? What are you doing?
You know, it's a simple question. You know this meme of, you know, what do I think I do? What my mom thinks I do? You know. What does the world think I do and what do I actually do? That's kind of how I feel when people ask me that question. So what do I think I do? Sometimes they think I'm like an international like secret agent. I have a friend that that calls me the Catholic Jason Bourne.
Yep, I can see that.
Or the Catholic Indiana Jones or something like that. So that's what I think I do a lot of times. What does my mom think I do? This is really funny. So at Thanksgiving, my sister was there. She lives in San Francisco. We only get to see each other a couple times a year. And so she was promoting the rumor that I was like nobody really knows what I do. And so... You know, she's like, you're traveling the world. I see you in these, like, you know, wondrous places. I think you are into trafficking of some sort. And so then my cousins rallied around this idea. And, you know, it's just kind of funny. So my mom, really, every time I see her, she asks me, so, Ryan, I got asked the other day, what it is you do, and I don't really know how to explain it. So during Thanksgiving, I sat down with my sister, my mom, and we recorded like a 10-minute description, kind of like as a podcast thing, so that they could all like listen to it and remember what I do. So it's kind of funny. But what do I actually do? So I spent 9 years working for Catholic News Agency and her sister agencies, Assi Prensa,
in Spanish, and then there was a Portuguese, German, Italian editions, as well as church pop in those languages as well. And when we were acquired by EWTN, I guess it was maybe January 2015, I became the director of news operations for EWTN News. So I oversaw, you know, operations is kind of one of these nebulous terms. Basically, I oversaw all of, you know, the administrative, the editors reported to me, the bureau chief. So I was kind of involved in every aspect of all of our international news. And through that work, I met some really interesting people and within the church and also within venture capital and within the technological world. And I would get called up and asked to make introductions either at the Vatican or with this bishop or this person. And I started to see that there was a real market to kind of be that bridge. And so in March of this year, I formally left EWTN as Director of News Operations. I still do some intermittent consulting work for them. I was in Rome in October for the Synod on the Youth, helping them produce their daily shows. But I am involved in a couple of different interesting companies. One you know about, which is a blockchain-based company. We're in the process, pretty close to really kind of coming out publicly. I'll just give a general description. We're using blockchain to try to make the payment process and donation process simpler, more cost efficient, and more transparent. And so there's a lot to unpack there, and we're gaining some good traction. Also, working on my first book on Our Lady of Guadalupe. I am involved with another company in which we are building really, really interesting immersive multimedia experiences. So imagine you walk into kind of like a conference center room, you know, one of these big rooms of 7,000-8,000 square feet with high ceilings, and we totally transform this room with screens, with cutting edge sound equipment, and basically you walk into a total immersive experience in which we are building, we're scanning artwork, colonial artwork depicting the apparition and the miracle of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And so we're transforming all this artwork. You can animate it. So if you've ever seen this movie on Van Gogh, in which the artwork kind of comes to life, but respecting, you know, the form in which it was painted and all of that stuff. So we're in the early stages of raising money for this, and we've got some commitments from dioceses to bring that, hopefully the middle or third quarter of 2019. So really excited about that. And then in my free time, I do some kind of ad hoc consulting for a couple of dioceses in communications and strategic, I would say, communications.
Wow, that was quite a mouthful, man.
Hopefully we didn't lose any listeners totally there.
I can see why they needed a podcast for that.
But, and I still get 8 hours of sleep every night. That's a non-negotiable.
And that is the craziest part of your life and why I wanted to have you on the podcast to talk about your health habits. Just kidding. I think it's just, you are definitely one of the most interesting men in the Catholic world that I know of. The bilingual thing, the like mystery man who's scheming behind all of these different like major relationships, you know. When we first talked about because I knew you during your transition out of EWTN, and when we were talking about coming to the summit, the first conversation we had about you doing blockchain, I was just like, oh my gosh, there's a Catholic blockchain company out there, and Ryan, my friend, is a part of it. I've been hearing whispers like all over from like different people, like, oh, there's this Catholic blockchain thing that I'm involved with, and then turns out it's just Ryan.
Ryan's
the one running it. Yeah,
the stoic guy, conservatively dressed over there.
Yeah,
yep, that's him.
Yeah, he's the guy. So, but before you were the man behind all of the major happenings in the Catholic world, there was the young man Ryan who has had his whole life before him, trying to figure out his vocation and what he was going to do with his life. So to back me up to like kind of your Genesis story, maybe how your faith became important to you, and maybe a little bit more about like your time discerning in religious orders and all of that.
So I've had, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about this, because every time that I do, every time that I reflect on it, it just reminds me of God's love for me. You know, the way that He has always been present, the way that He's intervened in my life, the way that He's blessed me with the example of certain saints and Our Lady. It's just like, it's kind of a love story, you know? And so it always makes me happy and renews me in my faith to talk about it. So I grew up in a family in which I wasn't baptized. My parents were civilly married because they were previously married to other people in the church at a very young age, got divorced from their first spouses, and then married each other civilly. And we all know somebody that's kind of gone through that experience and the ruptures that a divorce brings. And it affected my parents as well. I think that they felt outside of the church for many years and wanted my sister, my younger sister and me, to make the choice, which is, you know, kind of common amongst baby boomer parents, right? For their kids to make the choice of faith. I think that personally, that's a mistake. But luckily, God blessed me from a very early age with a spiritual sensitivity. My mother's parents were very good, devout Catholics from the Italian world. My dad's side, the Irish. So I really looked to my grandparents as the one of having a great marriage, respect, living really heroic virtues in their marriage and also in the community. And so by the time I was, I don't know, maybe 9 years old, 10 years old, I went to a basketball camp, okay? And the coach of the Phoenix Suns put on this basketball camp back when they were good, when Charles Barkley played for them, and they lost to the Bulls in the finals in 6 games, which I'm still bitter about, freaking John Paxson hitting the three-pointer. But it was a Christian-based Bible camp. They were Protestants. And as Protestants do, they love the Bible.
There was an altar call?
What's that?
Was there an altar call?
There was absolutely an altar call. It wasn't around an altar, though. It was around a big campfire.
Oh, whoa.
And I went up.
That's cool.
I accepted Jesus that night into my heart. But I did not accept the Protestant faith into my heart. Just Jesus. And so I came back from...
Thank God.
What's that?
Oh, thank God for Protestants for like making Catholics answer altar calls,
They evangelized
give their lives
me,
to
though.
Jesus.
They evangelized me. And they did so by like, they had Bible trivia, and I am a competitive person, but I was also very competitive, maybe even more so as a child. So I was pissed off. I didn't know any of these answers. So you can imagine, you know, 9 or 10 year old Ryan getting picked up by his parents from camp and
still dressed
still
in a
dressed
suit,
in
just
a
completely
suit and tie.
Suit and tie.
Carrying his briefcase. and being asked, you know, how was it? You know, great. I made the all-star team, made a lot of friends, and lost Bible trivia every time. You know, and what I asked, this is the crazy thing. I asked my parents for a Bible. I'm like 9 or 10 years old.
So my dad buys me, you know, this is before Amazon, right? My dad buys me a children's Bible and I start reading it. And being the naturally curious, probably a little bit unique child that I was, I started asking them questions, and questions they probably had difficulties answering. And then I started to ask, okay, why don't we go to church? And so they took me to church, and I saw at the Mass, do you remember, did you have this in school, like a cafeteria, you know, the cafeteria ladies that cook the food and all that stuff? So I saw some of the cafeteria ladies at Mass, and I was like, oh, wow, you know? And I went up to receive communion, and my dad just like grabbed my arm and pulled me in. And he's like, you can't do that. And I, of course, I was upset. I was like, what do you mean I can't do that? And he goes, well, that's Jesus. And I was like, okay, if that's Jesus, well, I want him. And he's like, well, you're not baptized. And I was like, why the heck am I not baptized? And so it set this whole domino effect in which I was finally baptized, received First Communion, confirmed on Mother's Day, 1999. And so I received the trifecta of sacraments, and I was totally on fire, you know. And it's strange because as a 15-year-old, I was, you know, I was playing basketball, running track, cross country, you know, so I was kind of in the jock world, had my Letterman jacket. I was also an honor student, so I was, you know, hanging with the nerds. And at the same time, I was involved in church, and it was just like, I didn't really, like, people couldn't put me into one category, you know? So it was a really interesting time. Around 15 years old, I started to open my heart to the possibility of a religious vocation. The saint that I really began to get to know first was Saint Ignatius of Loyola. I kind of saw him as, like, a super badass, you know. Here he was, he got hit by a cannonball, you know, he was in the military, got hit by a cannonball, had this major conversion over, you know, the recuperating in bed. And my aunt bought me a book on Saint Ignatius for my confirmation baptism day, and I started reading it, and I was just like, man, this is a real masculine man who loved God with all his heart, mind, and soul, and changed the world. And so it was at that moment I said, I had never met a Jesuit, but I said I wanted to be one.
Little did you know.
Little did I know the whole complex history that would come about 400 plus years after the founding of the Jesuits. So I'll tell you, you know, when I was a senior in high school and I was thinking about colleges, I naturally gravitated towards the Jesuit ones because I thought I would encounter these Jesuits, I would encounter my vocation, and the rest would be history. And so I applied to a number of Jesuit schools, and the one that offered me the best scholarship package, including a scholarship to run cross country, was Regis University in Denver, a college that I never really had heard of.
I had you went to school like on a cross country scholarship?
Do we even know each other?
I just could not. I cannot believe that. Yeah, how did, man, I not know that? Wow.
I'm retired now, but I'm dusting off my running shoes and trying to get back into it. Yeah, so I was a college cross-country runner. I was a captain of our team.
Damn, that's crazy.
I wasn't.
Do you know what your 5K PR was?
In high school, so in high school we ran 5Ks, and in college it was 8 and 10Ks. I think my best time was in the 15 minutes in high school. 15-minute 5K in high school or something.
Dude, that's awesome, though. Yeah, I'm sure we could share a lot of stories. I think it's like one of the coolest sports ever.
It is.
It's like one of the most spiritual like things, too. I think that the training that I have for spiritual attentiveness and like meditation for endurance, like discipline, a lot of that came from running cross country. And I was just talking to Angela Schneiders. I don't know if you know her very well, but I keep on finding like these people that I've like entrepreneurs who ran cross country and that was their thing. Just like totally unexpected. But
I totally agree with you about the discipline. I mean, I ran, so I'm from Scottsdale, Arizona, and we would train in the freaking summer here. We'd get up at 4:45 in the morning. We'd meet at 5 because, you know, it's so hot in the summer. And, you know, you spend your high school summers waking up at 4:45 to go run. And there was, you know, sometimes we would do 2-a-days. We would run at 5 p.m. And so I remember times when we were out there, there was a heat advisory and it's like 110 degrees outside and you're running. And if that doesn't, you know, help form you to push through, you know, difficulties, I don't know what does.
Yeah, that's amazing. And just like, you know, what do you think about for like 6 miles when you're in pain? It's this whole mental experience that I think teaches you how to get into flow and all these other words that like entrepreneurs are using now in Silicon Valley and stuff. But yeah, it's just this mental discipline that's also a big part of it. So yeah. So you were running in college, and was that when you started becoming really serious about discerning like religious vocation?
So my first semester in college was my first crisis in life.
Perfect.
Yes,
that was the cliffhanger we needed. Yes. At this point in the podcast.
Yeah, there were many crises to come after that, but this was my first like real crisis. So I had a coach that I learned to love and become good friends with, but that first semester was just brutal. You know, I'm running at mile high altitudes and even higher at you know, we ran in Gunnison, Colorado, you know, probably 8,000 or 9,000 feet. And it was just so difficult. I didn't have the same chemistry with my team. My grades were suffering a little bit. I was that first half of the semester, believe it or not, I was taking a religious studies class and I had a C halfway through. I was always like a straight A kind of student, but I had a super liberal professor that anyway had a lot of conflicts with. I discerned. I met with the Jesuits. I began discerning with them, and I discovered, you know, Jesuits that were not the ones that I was reading about. And this is 2002, and you've got the sexual abuse crisis coming out. The priest that had baptized me was being accused. The bishop of Phoenix had just been involved in a hit and run where he was intoxicated, and the person he hit ended up dying. And so like there was just so much going on where I was just like, I don't want to be here. So I quickly discovered I was not called to the Jesuit vocation. I tried to transfer. I began to look at transferring out, and my mother, who up until then had not been a huge spiritual influence on my life, told me, Ryan, you need to pray about this. You know, I know you're having a hard time, but you need to pray about it. And a good friend of mine had given me a yearly Bible book. You know, each day is Bible passages. And so I opened it up. It was November 18th, 2002. And the reading from the Old Testament was Ezekiel chapter 34, which is about the Good Shepherd. And I read that, and it was the first time I had encountered Ezekiel. And I just said to myself, you know, the flock here at Regis University is without good shepherds. You know, I kind of saw some of the priests that were there that were teaching things that went against our faith. And so I made a decision that night in prayer that I was going to stay and that I was going to become a good shepherd there. And I was going to find other good shepherds. And we were going to do our own kind of student-led group. And this is right around the time Focus is consolidating. And we kind of created our own little ad hoc focus without any funds or anything like that. And I became, along with probably about 10 friends that I met along the way, an apostle on that campus.
That's amazing. So did you, like, I guess in that time, there's this like endurance that you're starting to experience. You're leaning into the difficulty and into the race, if you will. And we're also starting to see your kind of creative, like, leadership juices start to flow, where you're taking ownership over the situation rather than like moving away from the situation, like becoming the change you want to see kind of thing. So, and that's at a very difficult time in the church's history. And I've definitely, as we've talked, it seems like that's been a major thread in all of your conversations. You know, you're definitely a reformer, and that's one of your biggest causes. And it sounds like there was a lot of, I guess in this time, a kind of a commitment to making that your banner wave, right? So tell me a little bit about some of the formational experiences of leadership that you got there that led to kind of who you are now.
It's really interesting that you kind of put that in a frame of a reformer. I had never really identified myself, I guess, with that title, but effectively that's what I've done, or tried to cooperate with. At Regis, you know, we did student-led groups, and I remember one of the first people that we invited was Archbishop Chaput, who was the Archbishop of Denver at the time. And I was just so blessed to develop a friendship with him. He later converted into my spiritual director. He
wow.
helped, yeah. Talk about, you know, winning
the
spiritual
there,
lottery there. he was amazing. He is amazing. I'm blessed to still, you know, have pretty regular contact with him. But he helped form me in, I would consider him really my spiritual father. He helped form me to be stronger psychologically. He challenged me. This might be one of the most important things that he taught me. He said, "Ryan, you really need to go to confession every single month." You know, I hadn't gone to Catholic school. I didn't receive like kind of that traditional Catholic family upbringing. Everything that I had really learned up until then, this is a super geeky thing, but I would ride my bike to the library, and I studied like in early on when the curiosity was being sparked. I would study and read about the different religions and the church history and things like that. So I was all self-taught. But the thing that he told me that has totally transformed my life is you need to go to confession regularly. And ever since that moment, I can't think of a time in my life, and I've been through some times in which I definitely drifted away from being coherent, but I still went to confession every single month. And I've just developed a habit to even try to go, for many years, I went weekly. And I just think as a Catholic, like, that gift of reconciliation, besides obviously receiving the Lord's body and bread, but to be body and blood, but to be in a state of grace constantly, to develop the humility, to ask for forgiveness, to have that introspection and that reflection on one's life, that may be one of the greatest gifts that, you know, the Archbishop instilled in me. And anytime I'm accompanying somebody coming back to the faith, that's something that I try to stress with them is just really frequent and good confession.
Hmm. That's beautiful. And I think that there's like so much in when somebody picks you out as a mentor there, it's not so much like the lessons that they themselves just teach you in words, but there's this like imprint of their spirituality upon you that happens, even if there's not a formal laying on of hands. You kind of take in who they are as a human and as a mystic. So one, I think the introspection, the sense of like consistency in that, that's all really beautiful. But one of the things that I'm just really interested in is, I'm sure that he doesn't just take on any spiritual directee, you know, like there's, for him to do that, he had to see something in you. Like, what did he see in you that made him, yeah, reach out to you, take you on, kind of bring you into his confidence?
What's interesting, so great question. And when he and I saw each other a couple months ago, we were kind of reflecting on this. I remember the first time that I actually met him. It was at the Focus Conference in 2004 in Denver. And he was giving a standing room only talk. And at the conclusion of the talk, he was walking up the center aisle and he was just kind of greeting people. And he greeted me and he asked me my name. And I told him I was going to school at Regis. And he said, "Oh, great. You know, why don't you come to the cathedral on Sunday for mass?" And he just kind of threw his net out there. And I felt so comfortable with him. I had never really had much contact with a bishop before, but he did. He brought the church close to me, and so I did go to mass afterwards. And then I invited him to Regis to talk, and I think he saw in me a certain leadership and courage to announce the truth of the gospel in an ironically like hostile Catholic environment, which happened to be a Jesuit Catholic school. And I think that, you know, he and I walked through the discernment process, and I discerned with him the vocation to the diocesan priesthood for some months. And ultimately, you know, my conclusion was I wasn't made for a life like living alone. I needed a wife or community. But I think what he saw, to just go back to your question, was a zeal. You know, oftentimes, and I was accused of this when I was at Regis, I started writing some commentary in the newspaper.
Things.
there was a petition to censor me at one point because I was just too quote unquote zealous.
Nice.
Yeah. I have that article somewhere.
I feel like anybody that's got anything worth saying, when they were in college, they wrote things that made enemies.
Yes.
Like, that's just the time, you know, you got all fire and no prudence yet.
it's just so like true. It's so
unfiltered
true.
Zeal.
But that's, you know, that's also I think one of the gifts of the youth, right, is this energy, this ability to challenge, to speak our minds. Of course, that needs to be tempered. And I think Pope Francis has emphasized this over the last 5 or 6 years, is the importance of the youth and the elderly having a relationship, because there's an exchange of gifts there that God has given us. But certainly, to your point, I was zealous. I was taking on the administration. I'm not going to say that I always was courageous. There was one time I got into a shouting match with a priest out in the quad over something. You know, there were times when I was afraid. There was times where I was irrational, but I'm thankful for the accompaniment of my spiritual directors to, you know, kind of navigate some of that and to temper things and to be a little more prudent sometimes.
I mean, that's definitely, you can see that in Jesus too, as he's picking his disciples. It's like, he definitely doesn't pick them for polish.
I was polished either.
Yeah, you weren't wearing the suit yet. This was
no, that
later development.
Been the only thing that was polished. The rest, not so much.
But, this is one of the things that I'm really interested in, because most of the people that I know who have, myself included, who have that kind of like I went to seminary and I left everything behind to go all out, fought all my teachers with the sharpest words that I could find in classrooms when everybody else was like dozing off at 8 a.m. I'm like, you know, really going back and forth on, pulling teeth on the historical critical method or whatever. And there was times though that I saw later on in my life where my kind of black and whiteness had to get really like, the zeal had to stay there, but I had to really get crushed in order to be able to have empathy for those who were not where I was. And I know that like you're later on when you had that experience of really committed discernment, the religious order, was that kind of part of your learning empathy, like sort of being crushed in that time?
So you're bringing up some really, really good points. And I'll just wrap up real quick my vocational discernment that you're touching on. So after I graduated from Regis, I spent some time at Georgetown studying. I was at an institute for economics and politics. And Archbishop Chaput has always really encouraged young people to consider going into public policy because we need good Catholics there. And so I did my stint there. My mom got breast cancer, and thankfully she's a survivor and doing great, 10 plus years later. But I made a decision to move back to Arizona, take a job at an investment company. And I was there doing really well, advancing, making money, blah, 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 for about 3 years. But during that time, I started to drift away from being coherent in my faith. The world was pulling me hard. Money, you know, all of the typical challenges.
Can you give me like an example of what that looked like? I mean, it does sound like a pretty fun part of the story.
So what did it look like? I was a part of this. So I worked for the Vanguard Group. They're now close to becoming the largest money manager in the world, trillions and trillions under management. And each year they selected about seven high potential college graduates for a leadership development program. They had three offices. One was in my hometown of Scottsdale. And so I got accepted to the program, and we were like the golden kids, you know, the golden children that were going to be the future leaders of the company. So we would come into a department, land in there for 3 months, learn everything we could, and then move on to the next one. We got the, you know, pick up at the airport in the Lincoln Town car. We got this, that, and the other. We made significantly more money than the other people we were working with. And at the end of this, graduating through this program, they placed me as a supervisor of a high net worth business development team. So it was a crazy experience, learned a lot. My little sales team in 2 or 3 months, we became the top grossing sales team in the company. And then I got another promotion.
Like,
and
everything it's like turning to gold. Oh, what are you doing, man? What's
no,
the
not everything, the thing? Not everything. I'll tell you some, we'll get to some other parts of some crashing and burning. But you can imagine how that, all that success, especially early on in my case, you know, in some people's cases, it's tragedy that pulls you away from God. In my case, it's been success. And so to be really transparent, I was really suffering from emptiness at that time because I had things that you would say, you should be happy. You should be, you know, you have things of the world and this and that. And I was going out and I was partying. I was drinking too much. I was, you know, chasing after girls, and I would wake up, you know, hungover the next day. Sometimes it was a Wednesday morning, you know, and I had to go to work. Sometimes it was a Sunday morning and I didn't want to get up and go to mass. And I just woke up feeling just really empty. and with a realization that I was being reckless. And part of the recklessness, Anthony, was a failed relationship that I had with a girl that I really had fallen in love with. And we had been discerning marriage, and she broke up because she wanted to answer the question of whether or not she had a religious vocation. And so that set off in me an anger towards God, because I felt like he was stealing her away from me. And as a consequence, I rebelled.
Wow. That's a very intense rebellion.
Yes. Yes.
Like, were you, so you're doing the investor thing and you're angry at God. Like, what changed that anger, made that, sort of gave that healing that you needed?
So I never stopped going to Mass. I've never stopped going to the monthly confession, but my heart got so hard. You know, it was obligation. It was duty that was driving me there. I had really lost belief in a loving God, and I started to try to look for a third way, you know, I read some stupid New Age book, which, you know, this came out at the time, The Secret, and, you know, I started to like look into that stuff, but it was just so stupid, so superficial, you know, that I just outright rejected it. Then I looked more in the temporal sense, and I looked towards science, you know, and I started to read books on evolution and, you know, the beauty and the perfection of science. But every freaking thing just kept pointing back to God, you know. And I remember one time, this is around the time.
Gotta hate how that works.
I know. Like, I don't know if you've come across the poem, The Hound for Heaven or something like that. Of Heaven.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That that's my experience, is that like God just kept hounding me. You know, I couldn't escape him. And so, you know, I remember at the time the show Planet Earth came out, and I was watching it, and it was at this time when I was just like full into reading books on science. And there's this scene where you're in the jungle and a big tree falls down and it just wipes out like a whole section of the jungle. And they show this time lapse of how these plants just race to the top because now there's light where there wasn't light. And I just was so touched by, you know, the beauty and the interconnectedness of everything. And everything was just like screaming a God of love, but I didn't want to accept that. So then I couldn't go back directly to God, and this is often, you know, kind of the beauty of being Catholic. I started to read some books on the saints, and they started to pull me back, you know, and then I started to, you know, then I made a really, really good confession, and it broke the hardness in my heart and set off a series of events in which I ended up contacting Archbishop Chaput, who I had neglected to contact for spiritual direction for basically that whole year of rebellion. And I told him what was going on, and I told him that, you know, I basically gave him a phone confession. And I said, I need a reboot. I need, you know, like shock, love, reconciliation therapy. And he's a practical man. So he goes, okay, well, what does that mean? What do you want to do? And I had been blessed with the experience of encountering Mother Teresa through a documentary that I had picked up at Blockbuster. You remember Blockbuster? this is 2008. And I watched this documentary, Anthony, and I just started crying, because she had the virtues that I lacked. She wasn't beautiful. She didn't have money. Her English wasn't great. You know, like all of these things that the world says you need. But she had God. She had love. She had charity, And those were the things I was yearning for. So I saw all of that and it just broke my heart. And so I told Archbishop Chaput, I said, I want to take a year off, go to a developing country and work with the poor. And so he put me in touch with a religious community down there. I told him I wanted to go to South America because I had, you know, studied 1 year of Spanish in college, which is a joke because we all know we don't learn anything there. But at least I wasn't starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. And so he put me in contact with a community down there. The next day, I was offered a promotion to move to Philadelphia to oversee the whole sales department in Philadelphia, which had about $1.5 billion of revenue. And I just turned 25. And so this was like a freaking dream job. And prophetically, Archbishop Chaput warned me. He said, you'll probably get a temptation. You'll probably get a promotion. You'll probably get something like this that will deter you from following God. And so I ended up turning down. Go ahead.
Do you think Satan sets that shit up? Like, is he like actually making that happen? Or is it, I mean, like, why is that a thing? Because I've experienced that. I've seen it all over. It is like there's this war in the world that's happening over your soul. And there's a decision that's being like you're brought to this fork in the road that makes it just like puts the stakes up a little bit higher. So, yeah, why does that happen?
I think, you know, we can't say definitively if it's Satan. There were a lot of things that, you know, I had put into motion that allowed me to be, you know, in that position. But the timing of it all, like everything is suspect, right? So why does that happen? That happens because ultimately Satan wants one thing. He wants our death. He wants our spiritual death. And then he wants our physical death. You know, he hates us. So the greatest temptations that I've had in my life have been in crucial moments of discernment, of decision. And I think this reinforces the idea that we need spiritual accompaniment, because often the person that's involved in it, Satan is so clever, he's so astute that he does it in an attractive way. That's the whole thing with sin, right? We don't choose sin because it looks bad. We choose it because it looks amazing, right? It appears as something really great for us. So luckily, I had the blessing of being accompanied during these times of major decision in my life in which, you know, like you said, the question is this of God or is this of the devil? So it's a good question, huh?
Yeah. At that point, did you just like, all right, I'm quitting? Or you take longer?
No, so this is September 9th, September 8th, I'm sorry, the Nativity of the Blessed Virgin, but I didn't know that at the time.
Wow.
And
you got those Marian feast days on lock, man.
I do. You know, it took me years to realize Mary's silent but active role in my life. And I'll tell you, I didn't know what September 8th was for a couple more years after that. I'm really good at remembering dates. And so when I did, you know, kind of connect the dots, I went back and I saw how crucial she's been on those Marian feast days in my life. And so I think that if there's something else I could just accent, is something that, you know, the church is always, especially a lot of great spiritual masters have emphasized is the memory. Like the memory of our conversion, the memory of death, as the Franciscans kind of celebrate it, the memory of God's active role in our life. Because when we have that memory, it sparks gratitude in our heart. And from that gratitude, if we're grateful, sin can almost not touch us. So it's September 8th, I reject the job offer, which is crazy because September 8, 2008, this is when the market is collapsing.
okay, total collapse, and I'm working for, you know, one of the biggest investment companies in the world. One of the only companies that actually had positive cash flow, because people were leaving all the other companies and coming to us at the time because we were the ethical guys. And so my boss, when I turned down the promotion and told him I needed to quit, you can imagine the sky is falling. You've got like one of your young lieutenants rejecting a promotion, quitting, and he's telling you he's moving to South America. I mean, you know, the guy probably wanted to take my temperature.
Yeah, I'm sure. What did he say?
He actually asked if I could explain why to him. And so I told him, you know, there are also more details than I want to say because of the length of the podcast, but I had small miracles occur to me. You remember that crucial decision in college where I opened up, it's Ezekiel chapter 34. Well, I found myself, there's a Spanish mission south of Tucson, Arizona, near the border with Mexico. I was there, and the mission is called San Javier del Bac, for St. Francis Xavier, Jesuit patron of missionaries. And I went there to pray to make the final kind of decision about whether or not I was going to quit my job. And it was a Sunday, it must have been September 7th or something. And I just asked God, and I never do this, but I just said, I need a sign. And the first reading that day was Ezekiel chapter 35. And I just had like an overwhelming sensation that God was saying, I want you to continue in my plan in the next chapter for your life. And so I told my boss this, I gave him the details. He starts crying. I mean, he just starts bawling. He starts telling me about his desire to come back to Jesus and the church and this and that. And so it was really an interesting moment where my coworkers either thought I was nuts or they would, you know, ask me to go out to lunch and, you know, kind of confess their issues to me. And, you know, I converted instantly into like a little spiritual director for some of these people, even though I was in no place because I still wasn't living a really coherent life, you know?
Yeah. So South America though.
Yeah. So my boss says, stay on until the end of the year. You know, everything's hitting the fan. You get a Christmas bonus, which was miserable because of, you know, what ended up happening in the market, but it at least, you know, kind of bought my ticket and, you know, paid some of my expenses to get down there. I get down to Lima, Peru, and I basically live in a constant state of crisis for the first 3 months because it's so chaotic. I can't communicate. It's loud. Like, I just couldn't imagine what it would be like. And I went down there without the intention to discern. I just went down there with the intention of recovering my faith. And within a couple of months of spiritual direction, of living a more coherent life, just really, you know, this is another thing that when I come across people that want to change their life that have been struggling with alcohol, drugs, sex, whatever the addictions are, is to really remove yourself from those, just like in AA, right? They tell you to really remove yourself from those circumstances. And so that to me was a time of detox. I couldn't communicate. I didn't really know anyone down there. You know, all of my friends basically became friends that were involved with this community, the Christian Life Movement. And so I ended up starting to discern with them and went through a very, very, very fast vocational discernment process. Ultimately, you know, years later, I realized that that was a mistake. It was imprudent. So I entered the formation process, which was in a little fishing town about 2 hours south of Lima, lived right on the water. The town was 5,000 people, and we swam in the ocean every day. And it sounds fun, but it was like real hard exercise. Didn't matter if it was 70 degrees outside or 40 degrees, we were swimming in that ocean. But the process really, I learned so much, Anthony, about church history, culture. I learned Spanish. I developed a real deep spiritual life. I worked on my psychological life. And I learned how to be a man with other men, which is, this might sound strange, but I'm convinced that there's a crisis of masculinity, especially in the Western world. And I learned how to, you know, really share who I am, my thoughts, my feelings, but in a masculine way. I learned how to have good dialogue with people. So I was really blessed with that. I lived in Peru for 4 years. Then I moved to Chile, where I lived for 2 years and opened up an office for Catholic News Agency and the Spanish sister office, agency down there. And then when EWTN acquired CNA, I moved back to Denver, where I lived for 2 years. So I spent a total of 9 years as a friar in this community. And ultimately, I discerned that it wasn't my vocation. There were some scandals in the community with the founder, who had committed psychological, spiritual, and maybe one or two sexual abuses. And he was the one that really accompanied me during my discernment. And I just, like I said, it was very rushed. It was a little bit manipulated. And so for the last year and a half or so, I've reincorporated into the world as a single person.
Man, how does it feel?
It provokes the question, what the heck happened during those 10 years I was away? Man, things got a lot worse.
Really? That's how you're like, holy shit. What happened to the world?
Yeah.
Dating apps, man.
What happened to the dating
apps
world?
Is what happened to the dating world. I feel like a documentary about you dating would be like a really fun experience to watch. Very profound.
Oh my gosh. You know, I almost accepted. So I was on a dating app, it was Hinge. I don't know if you've ever heard of Hinge. I was on that. And I got contacted by two women who were, I don't remember what the term is, but basically they're kind of like recruiters for a reality dating show, kind of like The Bachelor. And they tried to recruit me onto two different shows.
Come on, man! Come on!
Now listen to this. So I tell Archbishop Chappie this, and he says, you should really consider it. And
I'm thank like, God.
What? And he said, well, think about it. You can give a great testimony of, you know, a good Catholic man, this, that, and the other, and just put into the contract that you have to call me for spiritual direction every day so we can talk through, you know, the temptations and all of that stuff. So I did the interview. They really liked me. They offered me the position, but then I got cold feet.
No, Ryan.
Yeah, I pulled out.
Oh man, wow, what could have been? I would have watched that show every week. I would have watched it every week, even if I didn't know you. This is why, Ryan, you are the most interesting man in the world. Like, it doesn't surprise me at all that actually happened to you.
Oh man, I'm actually thankful. I'm thankful that I didn't do it. I think that, I don't know. I mean, the way that things are kind of manipulated on TV and all of that stuff, Yeah,
you actually really can't control the image, you know, they do. So I get that for sure. But either way, it seems like you got the actual Navy SEAL sort of Jesuit of missionary religious order training that you'd always been looking for, you know? I think it's also awesome too that it became this. I mean, I've called you the like Francis Xavier of like blockchain, you know, like that the way that he had this incredible training to to be able to go out and navigate in an excellent way in the world that gave him credibility to preach the gospel. Like, it, that's definitely been something that I've seen in your story as you've exited the more like religious order part of your life and entered more into the, like the lay vocation as a missionary. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
You know, what's interesting. First, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about that, because I think that's super interesting question. I think in the year and a half that I've been living a single lay life, I've actually had greater opportunities to evangelize than I did before, which I think is a confirmation that I'm in the right vocation. In March of this year, I helped co-organize with a number of very talented other people the first Vatican Hackathon. So for the folks that are listening that don't know what a hackathon is, you know, you got the word hacker and marathon put together. And basically, we had three issues that we wanted college students to offer solutions through technology to. The first one was social inclusion. The second was the immigrant crisis, and the third one was interreligious dialogue. So we had students come from about 50 countries. There were about 150 students from 25 of the top universities around the world. And I brought, I moderated a panel on ethics and technology. And I brought in some people like the executive director, former executive director of the Ethereum Foundation, which is really the most important blockchain initiative, Ming Chan, wonderful woman that I'm going to talk to after we get off this podcast. The invitation came at a really crucial point in her life because she was just leaving Ethereum, and she was wanting to get back in touch with her faith. And so this was like the perfect intersection for her. Another guy that I've become very good friends with, Wilson Tang, was the creative director for Industrial Light and Magic, you know, for the George Lucas firm, worked on a couple of the Star Wars films, The Hulk, a number of different things like that. Also a Chinese cat, raised Chinese Catholic. And we're doing some work together on an augmented reality company. But again, intersection, faith, technology, social causes. I was blessed to be able to bring both Ming and Wilson with me to the papal audience. And we got to meet Pope Francis and tell him a little bit about what they were doing. And he gave us the mission. He said, don't forget to put the human person in the center of everything you do. Technology has to serve the human person, not the other way around. And so I've just been blessed by the opportunity to take some creative ideas and introduce them to people who have spent their whole lives working in the corporate world, in technology, even in public policy, and kind of be a bridge. And what I found is oftentimes us Catholics are afraid to engage people like that. But I've kind of developed a style, probably through my formation, in which I lower the barrier, you know, for these people. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be loved. Everybody thinks pretty much that the world's not in a great spot. And so those are all commonalities at which I try to work from. We might have very different ideas of how to solve these things, but the church, despite the abuse, despite this, that, and the other, I have not found anybody resistant to working with me, to working, you know, I've actually found that I would say 100% of the people that I've worked with in the last year and a half have grown closer to God through these different projects and initiatives. And I would just emphasize, like, we have to really, this is something the Jesuits talk about, and I agree with it, is we have to meet people where they're at. The difference is we have to bring them closer to God. We can't allow them to bring us farther from God, but we really need to identify commonalities and begin from that.
Yeah, I think that comes too. I mean, there's so much about the Jesuit rule and the way that, you know, just the story of the founding of the Jesuits that makes so much sense to me. Like why they were able to be such influencers in the world for so many different reasons, not just by being missionaries, but even in the innovations that they created intellectually and culturally, economically. You know, it all was founded upon this incredibly deep interior life. You know, like, yes, mysticism was the thing that they were searching for first, the discernment, the ability to open oneself up and discern between like what is good, what is like the Lord speaking and what is not. If you are actually grounded in a really deep understanding of the human heart, of your human heart, and are playing at that level, then I have definitely found that opportunities have sort of like come out in a way that I could never have been able to even see or recognize or know how to approach before I had that that third eye, in a way. And one of the things that we've been doing and growing Sherwood Fellows in our own company, we just had this this feast. We have a feast every 6 months or so, and this one was the celebration of the last year of growth. And one of the big core beliefs that we've built the whole business on is that interior growth is going to lead to actual money in the end. Like if we really focus on growing spiritually together and growing as human beings, each individual, then overall we'll have opportunities that we couldn't have gotten before. And that turned out to be the case. And we were able to give like bonuses to everybody after affirming all of their, like all of these moments of deep spiritual growth that they've gone through, like then give them a huge bag of money, which like gave them bags. But it was this just amazing, amazing experience of seeing that reality, just happening in front of my eyes. You know, you're talking about the garden, like the way that all of it, like life was interconnected when you're watching that Nat Geo show, like this loving God where bounty, collaboration, community, interconnectedness and growth all are sort of part of the, like his heart for the world and for creation. And when I think of your story, I see that like the inner growth becoming this really huge explosion of fruit in the last year and a half of your life as you've like taken the shackles off, you know. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I really like how you categorized all of that. Speaking about the heart, I'm actually reading a book called The Heart by von Hildebrand. And
is it The Heart of the World or just The Heart?
It's just called The Heart, An Analysis of Human and Divine Affectivity. And highly recommend this book. This is a book that I'm kind of recommending right now. It's probably the third time that I'm reading it. But it really talks about, you know, in philosophy, you can see the identification of the body and the psychological world, right? In theology, we see, you know, we're invited to love God with our whole heart, mind, and soul. And that soul piece is really, you know, has been identified as the heart. And so when you were talking about the interconnectedness of the exterior environment and how that called me to God, I think also for ourselves, for creatives, for growing a business, for really harvesting fruit, so to speak, that interior connectedness is just so crucial. You know, that the fact that our body is a temple, right? What does that mean? The psychological life, you know, how do we work through, and we all have psychological issues, right? Some we've inherited, some we've developed. And the other piece is the heart, right? So to know what the movements of the soul are and what they're telling us, and what are we giving priority to? Are we, you know, because we woke up in the morning and we didn't get enough sleep, Does that totally transform how we see the world because we're cranky and how we deal with people? Or do we say, okay, body, you're tired, you're affecting my psychology, but you're a lower priority on the totem pole here. What does my soul say? My soul says, I still love God. I still love my neighbor. I still love myself. Like, I got a mission to do. I'm going to try to get better rest tonight. But that's not going to affect how my joy is, how I'm being called to respond to my mission. And so I think that, you know, the way that you categorize that is really beautiful, crucial, and is something that I try to work on every day.
I can totally see the cross-country runner in you in that statement. You know, like, I'm not going to listen to my body right now. I'm going to listen to my soul because my body says stop, you know?
Yes, like the it's true, though.
It's the mental war you're going through the entire way, no matter how tired you are. For some reason, your body is just like, oh, no, not today. Today, I shouldn't do this because, you know, and you just have to have that like inner dialogue to bring it along with you the whole way through. And you can definitely see that in the way that you approach the world.
Yeah. And I think the parents that are listening can understand that even better than you and I. I mean, if your child is sick or crying or whatever at 2 a.m, you're not going to just like keep sleeping, right? Yeah. You're going to tell your body there's a higher priority there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I definitely want to ask tons more questions, but we're up on our time. So I'll just give you the last statement. If you, for everybody else that's listening to this, that is just in the earlier process, the earlier stages of starting their own businesses, their own hustles, or they're stepping into new levels of leadership in their organizations, or they're just parents that are really trying to figure out how to lead and create beautiful cultures within their families. What advice would you give them from kind of all this that we've talked about in terms of your life and the way that you approach the world?
Yeah, I think a theme that we've talked about today is just this, I would call it, classify it as a healthy distrust of oneself. So what do I mean by that? I mean, we're not perfect beings yet, right? The idea is that we're in the process of becoming love. At some point, we will have perfection in heaven, perfection of love. But until we get there, we spoke about the temptation of the devil. There's the temptation of the world, which I referenced in my story that pulled really hard on me. And then there's the old man that St. Paul talks about, right? This is the unconverted self. This is the psychological problems that we have. This is the bad things that shoot up out of our heart that we say, holy smokes, where did that come from? So accompaniment from a mentor that's more advanced, both in the spiritual life and maybe even in the business life. If you can find somebody like that to help you navigate, to call you out when you're being spoiled or you're being prideful or petty or anything like that, I think that, you know, there are crucial moments in life and also in business where you just need somebody that you can go to that is going to be an objective third party that isn't afraid to have a real conversation with you and to potentially redirect you if necessary. That's been something that I would say has been a huge key to the things that I've been successful at. And in the ones that I haven't been successful at, many times it's because I was too prideful to invite somebody else into that situation to get good advice from.
Could you in like 3 words, 4 words, very short statement, say, like, give people direction on how to actually ask someone to be a mentor or a spiritual director?
This is a fantastic question. If I were to receive an email out of the blue from somebody that I'd never met, that'd be weird, right?
I'm asking for myself because I'm sitting on like this as a, I need to do this. And I've got like 3 people that I'm supposed, and I just think to myself, like, they would never, like, they're so far above me. They would never give me that time, you know? Like, it's just,
look, if they're so far above you, if that's true, especially in the spiritual sense,
they should have an openness to mentoring. I think that's a really important part of the maturity process. I think we should always be mentoring. You know, I know somebody, very successful businessman, great Catholic, but he has this kind of inferiority complex that you would never expect, where he's like, I can't give spiritual direction. I can't mentor somebody. And I think that's, mm-hmm. I think that's baloney. I think we should be receiving mentoring at all times, because there's always somebody that's more advanced, and there, we should be giving it too, because there's always somebody kind of younger or whatever. But to answer your question, I think, look, just be humble, be as natural as possible, ask somebody out for a coffee, a drink, or something like that, and just put it out there that, you know, you're at a crucial position in your life, and you'd like to be able to check in with them sometimes.
That's great. That's a really good way to do it. I'm at a crucial time in my life. I would love to check in with you at a few moments here and there.
Yeah. It doesn't imply too much of a commitment, but at the same time, you're opening up the channel for dialogue, right?
I love that. That's very practical advice. So last question is, where can people find you if they want to learn more about what you're doing or support things that you're up to?
internationalmanofmystery.com.
yeah. I don't think there's a website.
You're not going to find anything on there about me. I actually try to keep a fairly low profile. If you want to follow me on Instagram, that's probably where you'll see, you know, kind of posts and stories of where I am and what I'm doing. You can find me as RyanM_Thomas. I think that's probably the most practical way of finding me. I've got a website out there that I don't really update. But yeah, I'd say find me on Instagram and connect with me there. Send me a message. I'd love to learn what the other creatives are up to.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. And just so everybody knows, Ryan's working on a book for Our Lady of Guadalupe. It's going to be really groundbreaking. And we don't have all the details for that just yet, but look for it whenever it comes out, because it's going to be a huge deal. Could be forwarded by Pope Francis or Anthony D'Ambrosio.
Or both.
Or both. So yeah, thank you so much, Ryan, for coming on.
Amazing, Anthony. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. God bless, brother.
You too. Take care.